And now wait. Wait for a voice.
This is Ken Nordine. I come to you from out of darkness into a single point of light.
From this deep darkness, the mind accepts a single point of concentration. The senses are sharpened to it. All else is blacked out. And from any floating form or shifting shape, the midnight mind will see faces in the window.
Red Death had long devastated the country. No pestilence had ever been so fatal or so hideous. Blood was its sign. And it seemed the redness and the horror of life. Sharp pains and sudden dizziness and then profuse bleeding at the pores. And then a wasting away. The scarlet stains upon the body. Especially upon the face of the victims, with the terrible warnings which shut him out from the aid and from the sympathy of his fellow men. And the entire onslaught, its progress and fatal end, took but half an hour. But the Prince Prospero was unafraid. He was happy in his own security. Plans for escape from the bleeding death, for he was beyond the fate of the helpless and the common victims of his kingdom. When his dominion was half depopulated by the spreading plague, he summoned to his presence 1,000 healthy and light-hearted friends from among the knights and the women of his court. And with these he retired to the deep seclusion of one of his castles. Now, this was an extensive and magnificent structure, the creation of the prince's own eccentric taste. A strong and lofty wall encircled it. This wall had gates of iron. The guests, having entered, brought torches and massive hammers and welded the bolts. They resolved to leave no means of entrance nor of exit the sudden impulses of despair or frenzy from within. And the castle had ample provisions. With such precautions, the courtiers might defy this dread disease. The external world, less fortunate in it, could take care of itself. In the meantime, it was folly to grieve and to think. The prince had provided every form of pleasure and self-indulgence. There were clowns, ballet dancers, magicians. There were musicians and there was beauty. And there was wine. All of these and security were locked inside. Outside on the open plain, there was the Red Death. It was toward the close of the fifth or sixth month of his seclusion, and while the pestilence raged most furiously in the land, that the Prince Prospero entertained his 1,000 friends at a masked ball with the most unusual magnificence. It was a voluptuous scene, that masquerade. But first let me tell you the room in which it was held. There were 7, an imperial suite, The rooms were so irregularly placed that it was possible to see but little more than one at a time. It was a sharp turn at every 20 or 30 yards, and at each turn, a novel effect. To the right and left, in the middle of each wall, a tall and narrow Gothic window looked out upon a closed corridor, which wound around the suite. These windows were of stained glass, whose color varied in accordance with the prevailing hue of the decorations of the chamber into which it opened. The room at the eastern extremity, for example, was hung in blue, and vividly blue were its windows. The second chamber was purple in its ornaments and draperies, and here the window panes were purple. The third was green throughout, the fourth was furnished and lighted with orange, the fifth with white, the sixth with violet, and the seventh apartment was closely shrouded in black velvet tapestries that hung all over the ceiling and down the walls, falling in heavy folds upon a carpet of the same material and color. But in this chamber only, the color of the windows failed to correspond with the decorations. The panes here were scarlet, a deep blood color. Now, in no one of the seven apartments was there any lamp or candelabra. There was no light of any kind emanating from lamp or candle. But in the corridors that ran winding through the suite, there stood opposite to each window a heavy tripod bearing a brazier of fire that projected its rays through the tinted glass and so glaringly illuminated the room. And so there was produced a multitude of gaudy and fantastic appearances. But in the western or black chamber, the effect of the firelight that streamed upon the dark hangings through the blood-tinted panes was ghastly and produced so wild a look upon the faces of those who entered that there were few of the company bold enough to set foot within that room at all. It was in this apartment also that there stood against the western wall a gigantic ebony clock. Its pendulum swung to and fro with a dull, heavy, monotonous clang. When the minute hand had swept the full circle, the hour was to be struck, there came from the brazen lungs of the clock a sound that was clear and loud and deep and exceedingly musical. But of such a peculiar tone and accent that at the striking of each hour, the musicians were forced to pause momentarily in their performance to listen to it. And the dancers stopped their dancing, and a brief, subtle gloom came over the whole company. While the chimes still rang, you could see that the most joyous grew pale. The more aged and sedate passed their hands over their brows as if in confused reverie or meditation. When the echoes ceased, the light laughter of the company returned. The musicians looked at each other and smiled as if at their own nervousness and made whispered vows to each other that the next chiming of the clock should produce no similar emotion. And then when the next hour passed, there came another chiming of the clock and there was the same gloom, the same nervousness. The same meditation as before. But in spite of these things, or because of them, it was a gay and magnificent ball. The tastes of the prince were peculiar. He had a fine eye for color and effects. He disregarded mere fashion. His plans were bold and fiery, and his ideas glowed with barbaric luster. There are some who would have thought him mad. His followers, however, felt that he was not. It was necessary to hear, to see, and to touch him, to be sure he was not. He had designed most of the furnishings in the seven rooms, especially for this great festivity. And it was his own guiding taste which had given character to the masqueraders. You may be sure that they were grotesque. They were arabesque figures with unmatched limbs. They were delirious madman fancies. There was much of the beautiful, much of the wanton, much of the bizarre, something of the terrible, and not a little of that which excites disgust. To and fro in the seven chambers there stalked, in fact, a multitude of masked dreams. And these, the dreams, writhing in and out, taking color from the rooms, and causing the wild music of the orchestra to seem like the echo of their steps. And soon, there comes the music from the ebony clock, which stands in the hall of those. And then, for a moment, all is still except the voice of that. The dreams are stiff, frozen as they stand, but the echoes of the chime die away. They have endured but for an instant, and a light, half-subdued laughter floats after them as they depart. And now again the music swells, and the dreams live and writhe about more merrily than ever, taking color from the many tinted windows to which stream the rays of fire. But there are none now of the maskers who venture into the chamber to the west. For the night is waning away, and there flows a ruddier light through the blood-colored panes, and the blackness of the sable drapery chills to the very breath of death. But these other apartments were densely crowded, and in them beat feverishly the warmth and the heart of life. And the revel went whirlingly on until at length there commenced the sounding midnight upon the clock. And then the music ceased, as I have said, and the dancers were again quieted. But now there were 12 strokes to be sounded by the bell of the clock. And so with more time, perhaps it happened that some had thoughts that crept in horribly into their meditation. And perhaps, too, it happened that before the last echoes of the last chime had sunk into complete silence, there were many individuals in that room, in that crowd, who had found leisure to become aware of the presence of a masked figure which no one had seen before. And the rumor of this new presence was whispered around. And soon there arose from the whole company a buzz, a murmuring, an expression of disapproval and surprise, and then finally of terror and of horror and of disgust. An assembly of fantasies such as I have painted, it may well be supposed that no ordinary appearance could have excited such tension. There was no limit imposed on the masquerades that night. The figure in question had out-Heroded Herod, had gone beyond the bounds of even the prince's boundless taste. There are chords in the heart of the most reckless which cannot be touched without emotion. Even with the hopelessly lost, to whom life and death are equally a jest, there are matters of which no jests may be made. The whole company of wild revelers, in fact, now seemed to feel that in the costume and bearing of this stranger, there existed neither wit nor propriety. The figure was tall and gaunt and shrouded from head to foot in the garments of the grave. The mask which concealed the face was so nearly to resemble the countenance of a stiffened corpse that the closest scrutiny could not have detected. Yet all this might have been endured, if not approved, by the revelers. But the masquerader had gone so far as to assume the type of the Red Death. His costume was dotted with blood, and his broad brow and all the features of his face were sprinkled with a scarlet horror. When Prince Prospero saw this spectral image, he first shuddered in terror and distaste, but in the next moment, his brow reddened with rage, he shouted to the courtiers near him, "Who dares insult us with this blasphemous mockery? Seize him and unmask him." that we may know whom we hang at sunrise on our battlements. It was in the eastern or blue chamber that the Prince Prospero stood as he spoke these words. They rang throughout the seven rooms loudly and clearly, for the prince was a bold, robust man, and the music had become hushed at the waving of his hand. It was in the blue room where stood the prince, with a group of pale courtiers by his side. At first, as he spoke, there was a slight rushing movement of this group toward the intruder. From a certain nameless awe with which the masquerader inspired the whole party, there was none who dared put forth his hand to seize him, so that he passed untouched within the yard of the prince, while the vast assembly, as if with one impulse, shrank from the centers of the rooms to the walls. He made his way uninterruptedly and with a solemn and measured step. Walk through the blue chamber to the purple, through the purple to the green to the orange, through this to the white to the violet, before a decided movement had been made to stop him. It was then, however, that the Prince Prospero, maddening with rage and shame at his own momentary cowardice, rushed hurriedly through the six chambers, though none followed him, for the deadly terror had seized them all. He held a dagger above his head and had approached within 3 or 4 feet of the retreating figure, who had just reached the edge of the velvet apartment, when the figure suddenly turned and confronted him. There was a sharp cry, and the dagger dropped gleaming upon the sable carpet, and in the next instant, the Prince Prospero fell dead. And then, summoning the wild courage of despair, a throng of revelers threw themselves into the black apartment and, seizing the masquerader, whose tall figure stood erect and motionless, tore violently at his mask and costume. And they fell back like a rushing wave, gasping in unutterable horror, for beneath the grave shrouds and the corpse-like mask, there was no tangible form. Now they understood the presence of the Red Death. He had come like a thief in the night, come to strike down the high in their security and the low in their desolation. And one by one the revelers dropped in the blood-smeared halls of their revel, and each died in the despairing posture of this fall. And the life of the ebony clock went out with that of the last. The flames of the tripods expired, and darkness and decay and death has illimitable dominion over all. Mind at midnight is lonely, and the senses are sharp. And so from out of darkness of shape or form, where a single light is focused, the sharp and lonely midnight mind will see faces in the window. You have been listening to a reading of The Mask of the Red Death by Edgar Allan Poe, adapted by Marvin David, directed by David Waters, technical director Tom Bowles, lighting by Verlin Joffrey. Faces in the Window was created by Marvin David and George Heineman and featured Ken Nordine. And now, here's a message from Ken Nordine.
We'll say very few brief words of thank you to the many, many people who have written both me and Faces in the Window. And if you would like to have this program continue, we would appreciate your letters. Also, we would appreciate knowing the kind of stories that you would like to hear. And so until next Saturday, good night.